Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the final countdown of the 2012 election, not in Florida, but in Arizona, where final results will not be in until Friday. Jeff Biggers, author of State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream, joins us. We will discuss blatant voter suppression by Arizona's older white Republican establishment and their brazen attempt to disenfranchise 600,000 new and mostly young Latino voters who were sent to the wrong precincts, then issued provisional ballots that are still being counted by these same election officials. Then we'll examine the culture of scandal consuming Washington, with prominent officials becoming object of salacious media coverage as their careers are ended and judged on sexual peccadilloes rather on their performance in office. Veteran investigative journalist Mark Feldstein, the author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture, joins us to discuss the politics behind this latest sexual soap opera with military groupies fighting over which general they can seduce. Then finally, we'll get a less than flattering portrait of General Petraeus from Colonel Douglas McGregor, a decorated combat veteran who, during the Gulf War, led the largest tank battle since World War II. We will discuss the so-called surges in Iraq and Afghanistan and whether General Petraeus is the heroic figure and battlefield game changer that the press and politicians have portrayed him as. Joining us now is Jeff Biggers, the American Book Award-winning author of several books of history and memoir, including The United States of Appalachia in the Sierra Madre and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, which received the Sierra Club's David Brower Award for Environmental Reporting. He was raised in Tucson, Arizona, and his latest book just out is State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. He writes regularly for Salon and the Huffington Post, among other publications, and performs monologues based on his work at theaters and festivals. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jeff Biggers.
Thanks for having me back, Ian.
And your new book, State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. The final showdown over this election is going on in Arizona, and Wednesday is a key day. After Wednesday, these provisional ballots, hundreds of thousands of which were given out, will be invalid unless people get them to the polls. There's huge backlogs of voting, counting, and I guess they're checking as well. This does seem like somehow, you know, the grumpy old white men are just trying to, eke out some revenge against these Latino upstarts who have the temerity to vote.
Right. Yeah, no, it's not only the final showdown, it really is the final countdown, as you say. You know, we had a record early Latino voting this month, Ian, and everyone was quite excited just to see the enthusiasm in the elections. You had several organizations, citizens groups, groups of youth who did amazing work to register tens of thousands of new voters. When those tens of thousands of new voters went to the polling booth, suddenly they didn't find their name on the registration ranks. They didn't find their name anywhere. They hadn't been contacted. They were given these provisional ballots. Nearly a third of the polling places actually were reduced from the 2008 election, so the lines were incredibly long already. It just seemed like a series of dubious obstacles that had been thrown at the Latino community precisely the same year when we thought there was going to be a record turnout. So I would agree with you. There are so many red flags being thrown up right now that I feel like we need some sort of investigation, no matter what the outcome will be, an investigation by either Department of Justice or some sort of legal entity.
Well, Jeff Biggers, it seems a lot of it's focused on Maricopa County, where, of course, the infamous Sheriff Joe Arpaio reigns over the place in a kind of feudal way. He's, of course, on the ballot, too. Now, a lot of the people on the ballots have had to revise concessions, including the Democrat who ran for the U.S. Senate, Richard Carmona.
It
looks like he was 78,000 votes behind Jeff Flake, the Republican, but there's something like 600,000 votes yet to be counted. Is that right?
Well, yes, statewide, 600,000. I think they're getting closer now, more to 350,000, 400,000.
Right.
He's polled within less than 4 percentage points right now. Richard Carmona, who is the former Surgeon General, who is running for Senate against Jeff Flake. And so that's really within the margin of error. And if you're talking about a state, where nearly a quarter of the ballots were not counted, I think we're talking about a potential outcome we really can't call yet. Arpaio's race, on the other hand, still seems to be a little bit out of reach. He's now about 7.5% ahead of his closest challenger, Paul Pinzon, a retired police chief there, a policeman there in Phoenix. So that race still might be out of contention. But definitely the U.S. Senate race with Carmona hasn't been called yet for many reasons. It's still in contention right now.
And again, I'm speaking with Jeff Biggers, who was raised in Tucson, Arizona. His latest book just out is State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. Now, the woman who was elected to the U.S. Congress, we have, of course, Senator Tammy Baldwin, who's referred to as the first openly gay United States senator. There's also a Democrat down there who's she's referred to as our first bisexual congressperson, right?
Right.
And she's squeaked in as a result of a revised count, hasn't she?
Right. In fact, it looks like we have the possibility of even having a Democratic majority in the House races in Arizona now. Kristen Sinema is the person who identifies herself as bisexual. She'll be representing this new district that largely is Tempe, and that's the student campus district of Arizona State University in that area. It was part of this redistricting plan that I think the Democrats had high hopes. So she pulled out a very close race against a Tea Party Republican. And also in the eastern part of the state, Ann Kirkpatrick, who formerly had been in the House, she's sort of a blue dog Democrat. It looks like she's eked out her race as well. So she'll be a Democrat representing the north, the southeastern part of Arizona. And then, of course, in Tucson, you have Raul Grijalva, who's a very progressive member of Congress, was easily elected, and Ed Pastor, who's a liberal centrist out of Phoenix and Tucson, and he easily was reelected. And then the final race, the fifth race that we haven't been able to call yet, is the position of Gabby Giffords that was taken over by Ron Barber. Of course, he won the interim race, and it's really neck and neck down there in Pima County whether or not he's going to win. But he's right at this moment. He's a few hundred votes ahead.
So, Jeff Biggers, this is all to do, at least in my assumption, and correct me if I'm wrong, this is all to do, isn't it, with this get-out-the-vote effort on the part of these young Latinos, high school kids, who went out and registered thousands and thousands of new voters. And I think it's quite poetic in a way that young kids are not even old enough to vote were able to pull this off.
Right. It was an amazing group called Promise Arizona in Action. They were teenagers, but also college students. And it was actually more than a dozen organizations within the state, all of them who were mobilized for various reasons as citizens groups, as people who were responding to both the outrage of SB 1070, the punitive immigration law, responding with their outrage to someone like Sheriff Arpaio, represented Maricopa County, but I think also representing a tremendous sense of enthusiasm about the electoral process itself. I think you're saying it is very poetic, and it's quite true. It reminds me, of course, as a historian, of what happened in the 1970s. Arizona was in the headlines in 1972 for a very egregious anti-migrant worker bill. We actually, once again, states were trying to copycat us with a law that said migrant workers couldn't have any strikes or boycotts during the harvest. Cesar Chavez, who was an Arizonan, came back, and he began the same process of registering new voters. In fact, he organized a registration drive that gained over 150,000 new voters that ultimately led to the election of Raul Castro, the Arizona Raul Castro, as governor in 1974. So there was a direct link between this kind of drive for new voters and an impact in the elections. And I think that's what we are awaiting for this year, and I think that's part of the shock and awe and dismay at these elections, is that while the rest of the nation was able to see the incredible surge of Latino voters in the very ground zero front lines of the immigration battle in Arizona, I think a lot of people feel like ultimately they've had their elections completely derailed. and their hopes and aspirations for democracy completely derailed by what clearly is a thinly veiled version of voter suppression, or at least voter derailment.
So let's talk about that, Jeff Biggers, the mechanics of how Arpaio and the officials in Maricopa County and other parts of Arizona have tried to thwart this get-out-the-vote effort on the part of Latinos, inspired and energized by these young high school and college kids. So what they registered a bunch of new voters, but when they went to vote, they were given provisional ballots. Is that what happened? Tell us what happened down there.
Yeah, essentially, there are many different sort of obstacles that happened. One is, due to the redistricting, a lot of people were in different ballot areas and polling stations. And there was confusion there that hadn't really been clarified by the recorder's office. At the same time, with these tens of thousands of new registrants, they got to where they thought they were supposed to go for their polling stations. And, of course, a very important little detail is the Maricopa County's recorder's office actually had sent out two erroneous statements saying that the election in Spanish was going to be on November 8th, when, in fact, it was November 6th. They tried to correct themselves, but, in fact, they made the mistake in other places. And they said that was just a harmless mistake they didn't mean to make. But, once again, it raised so many red flags of, why is this happening right now, particularly in a moment in history when you have this incredible surge of Latino voters? But to go back to our voters here, tens of thousands of new voters, they go to their voting poll, and their name is not on the list of registered voters. And therefore, they're handed what's called a conditional provisional ballot and says, hey, fill this out with the proper ID, and then we'll take it back and we'll check it against our records. And if you indeed are there, we'll count your ballot. So that's what these kids are doing now. We have an entire week of action that I've been covering there in Phoenix. It's going to culminate with a massive rally on Thursday. The final count is supposed to take place on Friday. So it really is a matter of days to legally all these ballots must be counted. But I think the big concern is whether some of these provisional ballots might be thrown out because for whatever reason they're not going to match up with the people who had registered.
So who are the people in the county recorder's office there in Maricopa County and other places? Are these white, you know, I referred earlier to this being a struggle between grumpy old white men and up-and-coming young Latinos who have a taste for democracy. So give us an idea about how the battle lines are drawn here. Is this really as racial and racist as it appears to be?
Right. You would like to think it's not, right? I think we're desperately trying to play this for what it is as a factual thing, but it's hard to avoid the obvious reality of what's taking place when so many of the provisional ballots are in heavily Latino voting districts and they're not in other districts in the state. You know, obviously there are provisional ballots everywhere, even in Los Angeles and Florida and Ohio. And this is the kind of situation, provisional ballots were it was something that was created to help people who had been disenfranchised. But here, suddenly, we're seeing a ridiculous amount, not only statewide, but particularly in Latino areas. And therefore, I think you do have to call into question, are Latinos once again being signaled out for some sort of racial profiling or discrimination? You know, Joe Arpaio is already under investigation by the Department of Justice for what they categorize as the worst cases of racial profiling in American history. And so here you have these political appointees, people like the recorder who are in office, who are Republicans, who are trying to play it by the book, but who, of course, are part of a system that has an incredible legacy of voter suppression. You know, any of your listeners who go back to the 1960s and 1970s recall the incredible role that former U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice William Rehnquist had in Phoenix. He cut his teeth as an attorney by going after black and Latino voters at the polling stations in Phoenix in the 1950s and 1960s. He was infamous for his role in voter suppression. And in fact, the feds have always been involved in Arizona's elections because of this legacy of voter suppression. So to think that somehow we jumped to 2012, where we're in the midst of this incredible demographic shift, that suddenly we have new ranks of Latino voters, that there's not some sort of racial profiling to go on, I think would be incredibly naive. So I definitely would agree with you that we have definitely a case that has to be investigated in some way, as I said previously, by the Department of Justice, exactly for this very reason, for racial profiling.
And two, you have to add to this hall of shame with Arpaio and the county recorder, you have the governor there, Jan Brewer, the one who poked her finger derisively at the president of the United States. I talked to a reporter down there with the Arizona Republic some time back, and he said, "Well, don't you understand? She's as dumb as a box of hammers." But
right, and she's all your fault too, because she's from California and she was part of that California wave.
Oh my God!
Arizona's been attempting to send her back, and even worse is she just floated the balloon yesterday that she's considering running for a third term. You know, she didn't actually have a full first term when she took over the office when Janet Napolitano was sent off to Washington. Our Constitution says she can only have two terms, and yesterday Brewer just floated her balloon to see if maybe she might challenge that in the courts to possibly run for a third time. So certainly she's looking through those elections. But this is the issue, Ian, that I think we've talked about in the past. 80% of the grayheads in Arizona, these retirees, folks like my parents, they're Anglos, they're whites. And 60 to 65% of the youth are Latino or brown, as we say. And so we're in the midst of this huge demographic shift that's going to play out in the election box, and we know it. And Cesar Chavez prophesized about it, you know, 30, 40 years ago when he said, finally, the people who get elected are going to reflect the people in the community. And I think that ultimately is what people like Brewer and Arpaio and this last cabal of Tea Party people are terrified of, and I think that ultimately is what is at play right now in what clearly is an element of voter suppression in this final election, this final showdown or countdown in Arizona.
Well, but throughout the country, what was heartening about the response to voter suppression was that it seemed to have backfired. For example, down in Florida, people, you know, stuck in line for hours and hours, 7-8 hours. They refused to back down. Obviously, there's no excusing this broken system that we have, this broken electoral system. But is that same sort of emotion going on in Arizona, where people know that people are trying to stop them from voting, and God damn it, they're not going to put up with it, you know?
Well, yeah. I mean, we've had vigils every single night since the election. You had all sorts of leaders. One person I've been covering closely is Randy Pottas, who is the young labor leader who came over and led the recall of former state senator Russell Pierce. And Randy Pottas was very involved in the whole campaign against Arpaio. He's been there every day with his ranks. You have at least a dozen citizens groups, Latino groups, community groups, along with the youth who are growing and growing every day, who are holding out major vigils all night, who have set up camp basically at the recorder's office, who are once again planning this major demonstration on Thursday before the final tally on Friday. And so I think, we haven't seen the end of this. If anything, I think the backlash against this kind of racial profiling, the backlash against SB 1070, the backlash against Arpaio, is just growing and growing, and this adds more fuel to the fire to really encourage and enthuse new ranks of people to come forward. So I think, if anything, I think this is the beginning of an even greater shift that we're going to see in Arizona. It may not happen with this election, but certainly it's going to play out in the next year or two.
Well, just in closing, though, Jeff Biggers, the same people who have been suppressing the vote, these kind of atavistic white relics, if you will, they're the ones that are counting the vote, aren't they?
Yeah, technically, yes. And so, I mean, here's a true level of do we trust them or not? And I think you have people who are right there trying to monitor this, but ultimately it is in the hands of the recorder's office. And so, I think we either have faith in the system or we don't, in terms of people who are accurately counting the ballots before them. You think that there'd be some sort of legal means to eventually follow up and check if there's been any discrepancies. But I think that's what worries people. And I think that's, you brought up a very important point. On Wednesday is the final day for people who were given a provisional ballot, who had been sort of a challenge for proper ID or whatnot, to actually follow through and come down and make sure that their ballot had been counted. And that's an enormous obstacle that's ultimately going to have a lot of people fall through the cracks who are not going to be able to show up in time. And I think that's what we're worried about, is whether they're counting the ballots accurately or not. There have been so many obstacles, so many barriers, so many ways in which they can derail the vote, that perhaps the voting will go against the Latinos this time around precisely for that reason, beyond just the sheer counting of the ballots.
Well, Jeff Biggers, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thanks for having me. Take care.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Jeff Biggers, the American Book Award-winning author of several books of history and memoir, including The United States of Appalachia, In the Sierra Madre, and Reckoning at Eagle Creek, which received the Sierra Club's David Brower Award for Environmental Reporting. He was raised in Tucson, Arizona, and his latest book just out is State Out of the Union, Arizona and the Final Showdown Over the American Dream. He writes regularly for Salon and the Huffington Post, among other publications, and performs monologues based on his work at theaters and festivals. We're going to take a brief station break and we'll be back talking about the scandal culture consuming Washington. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Mark Feldstein, who's a professor of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he has been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Feldstein.
Great to be here, Ian.
And clearly, scandal is back with us again, dominating the headlines, eclipsing even the fiscal cliff, which, of course, is something of an invention in itself. What's your sense, though, of what this brings up? I spoke yesterday with Tom Ricks, who's written a book called The Generals, and he made the point that, you could be an incompetent general, but as long as you keep your pants on, your career is safe. So here we have a what everybody considers a very talented general whose career has been ruined because he couldn't keep his pants on. What do you make of our priorities as a society?
Well, first of all, I doubt very much that Petraeus is the only general who hasn't kept his pants on. He got caught. But I hardly think he's unique that way. But, what we're seeing now is the sort of migrating of this scandal culture that has pervaded Washington for the past generation, in terms of politicians being exposed for their sexual peccadilloes, now to it hitting the military, which really hasn't been subjected to the same degree of scrutiny in the past about sort of consensual sexual relations. And I think it's the same problem for both. Adultery, consensual adultery, really matter for either a political or a military career? Ought that to be the standard by which we judge our leaders? Are we too puritanical? If that's all it is, if it involves an abuse of power, a misuse of the office in some way, then clearly it's a different situation. But from what we know so far, there have not been any allegations that I'm aware of involving criminal activity.
Well, of course, under military law, adultery is a crime, whereas the old adage about politicians is that all you have to do is make sure you don't get caught with a a live boy or a dead girl in bed. So
that's the old adage. And yeah, there are military rules against adultery, but A, I'm not defending those. B, by the accounts we have so far, the affair with Petraeus did not begin until he left the military, until he became CIA director. So, assuming that's actually true, then that wouldn't even really apply.
Sure. And the White House, of course, in a press briefing today, defended General Allen. I guess they're waiting to find out more about how inappropriate these emails were that he sent to this Florida woman who is Jill Kelly, who is at the center of the Petraeus scandal, in as much as she was the object of what was supposedly harassing emails from the girlfriend of General Petraeus, which began this whole thing. Now, the reason this happened, the FBI have a cyber unit, cyber crimes unit, but apparently it's incredibly difficult to prosecute cyber crimes or even get to the threshold, particularly harassment. The only reason that this even became an issue is because this woman in Florida, Jill Kelly, knew an FBI agent, the fellow who sent shirtless pictures of himself to her. And apparently he's a right-wing zealot. And he contacted Eric Cantor in the House of Representatives, and who in turn called the FBI. So it seems to me that that's why this has become a story that we probably would, it may well have been swept under the rug, but for this zealous right-wing FBI guy who believed, I think he watches Fox News, he believed that Petraeus was covering up the Benghazi scandal.
Well, there's a lot of information trickling in. You know, every few hours something new comes up, but I think your summary is essentially right. From what we know, this was indeed an agent who happened to have known Jill Kelly, the woman in Tampa, and seems to have had an agenda where he was reaching out to Republican politicians. And so it has all the earmarks of really sort of a partisan motivation. And it sounds like, and again, we don't know everything, but from what we know so far, it sounds like this investigation really was sort of at an impasse, that, you know, they discovered a consensual adultery, but not any criminal activity, and that it wasn't until Congressman Cantor, who is a Republican whip and the number two person in the House of Representatives and a very partisan figure, personally called the director of the FBI about it, that things seem to have kicked into high gear recently on the eve of the election. And so, you have to wonder if this really even merited the kind of criminal prosecution and national attention it's now being given.
And Mark Feldstein, again, professor of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. So is it, I think it's reasonable to assume, isn't it, Mark, that the president, even though Fox News is trying to gin up a scandal here, when did he know it? And, you know, the old Watergate adage, what did he know and when did he know it? It's pretty unlikely, isn't it, that the president, who was busy running for re-election, would have been briefed on this. I mean, I think, isn't this something that's really been blown up?
Well, from everything we know, yes, I think it's been blown up. You know, the media loves nothing more than a good sex scandal, and add to that a prominent name like Petraeus, who had an unblemished reputation previously, and it has all the makings of a good, juicy Washington scandal. Whether it actually matters is something else again. And, the odds that Obama in the frenzy of his campaign really was briefed about something like this would seem to be low, but you never know. Again, we don't know all the facts. But whether there was any wrongdoing is really the question. I mean, even if Obama knew about that, that in itself doesn't really prove anything. Now, maybe more things will come out of the woodwork if, in fact, there's any demonstration of the misuse or abuse of office by either of these military leaders to benefit their mistresses, if there was hush money that was paid, if there was perjury that was committed. You know, all of these things then raise it to the level of a criminal offense. If there was, classified material that wound up in hands they shouldn't have been, then that would justify this. But so far, there's no clear evidence of that. And so at this point, it sounds like a much ado about nothing. But, you know, I do hold the possibility open that it could turn into something greater. We certainly saw in the Clinton affair that, they ended up criminalizing, again, what was a consensual affair, essentially entrapping Clinton into perjuring himself. And he did break the law as a result. Whether anything similar happened here, we don't know yet.
Well, a lot of people from the beginning, Mark Feldstein, have wondered why Petraeus had resigned. And that question still remains, whether this was because his friend General Clapper suggested he should resign, as has been reported, or whether because he felt that he dishonored his profession. I don't know. But what's your sense? I mean,
well, the stories have changed, and this is the evolving nature of a story like that that makes it hard to make any final pronouncements, is that at first the message was spread by, because Petraeus isn't speaking directly yet to the public, to the press, at first the story was spread by his people that he himself voluntarily resigned as a matter of honor. Subsequent accounts have said, no, actually he didn't want to resign and wouldn't have resigned except for the fact that the Director of National Intelligence told him he should. So, but there is always the possibility that there is more wrongdoing that's taken place than we know of, and that with that knowledge he wanted to get ahead of the curve. We should find that out. There should be, with this much attention, I don't think anything's going to be able to be covered up, and we'll know then.
Well, it does seem, just on the surface, that this Paula Broadwell, Petraeus' girlfriend, does seem like maybe she could be a bit of a loose cannon. She recently was speaking to an audience in Denver where she offered up an interpretation of what happened in Benghazi, which again is worth noting, has become a media obsession of Fox News. They barely covered the election in the last few weeks. They led every night with this idea that there's a scandal, a political scandal involving the White House and what happened in Benghazi. She offered up Paula Broadwell the notion that the reason that the annex was attacked was because the CIA were keeping a couple of Libyans prisoner, and the jihadis were trying to spring them, and that's why they attacked. The CIA has vehemently denied it, that they're not in the business of holding people anymore in black sites, etc. So she's certainly opening a can of worms there, isn't she?
Well, conceivably. It's hard to know what her credibility is. If she was getting information directly from her boyfriend, the CIA director, then that would be something to take seriously. If she's just sort of speculating, then who knows? I mean, there's no question that by the canons of objective journalism, she should not have become sexually involved with, as her biographer, with the man she was writing about. That is generally a firing offense in most newsrooms. if you do that and don't disclose it and continue to cover someone and cover them in a laudatory way, the way she did in her biography.
Sure, but again,
that's not a criminal offense. Sure. That's if you will, a moral one.
Right. Well, it certainly gives new meaning to the title of her book about Petraeus, All In, doesn't it?
Well, she did speak quite openly on the Jon Stewart show about her ability to, her ability to penetrate the military, or maybe it was the other way around.
Well, it sounds like a lot of penetration was going on there. So tell me, though, about that leads me, and here I am getting into tabloid journalism. Mark Feldstein, again, author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington Scandal Culture. It looks as though, I mean, I don't know where this is going to pan out, but you get the feeling that there's kind of a these women like Paula Broadwell and Jill Kelly, and the fact that Paula Broadwell sent supposedly harassing emails to this woman telling her to back off and not go after her boyfriend, General Petraeus, and the fact that the FBI guy seemed to be soliciting attention by sending shirtless pictures of himself to her, and that General Allen had exchanged something between 20,000 and 30,000 emails with him, some of which were inappropriate, in quotes. I'm beginning to wonder whether, there's a group of sort of married women who are groupies for generals. I've heard about them for rock and roll stars. Does this strike you as a whole new arena of salaciousness?
Well, I doubt that there's much of anything that's new. You know, power has long been an aphrodisiac, as the saying goes, and you go back to the earliest days of our republic and, Jefferson and Hamilton and a lot of our so-called great men had mistresses, consensual or otherwise, and people who are powerful and are wealthy are used to having their way, and women often find that attractive. And the military culture is certainly one that is a macho culture. In the past, when there have been sexual scandals in the military, they've involved rape and harassment of enlistees, tail hook, and that kinds of things, where there were clear criminal offenses going on. This kind of thing is more tabloid, but I have a harder time seeing the necessary importance of it. You know, we are here in Washington facing, draconian budget cuts, and, the planet is going through warming. That's, there are a lot more important issues going on, but this is entertaining, and the ratings go up in the media, and we can decry it all we want, but the fact is it does appeal to, the lizard part of our brains in some primitive sense, and it's what gets everybody talking.
So do you think that we will have any kind of serious debate in this country about the absurdity between the idea that people's professional performance is immaterial when it comes to scandal? In other words, scandal trumps, and no matter you can be the best politician, the best general, the best sports star, no matter what. But if you have a sexual peccadillo, then you're ruined. And it makes me wonder at what point we're going to get our priorities right.
Well, that's a great question, and you'd think that maybe the Petraeus case, if there isn't more to it, might be a case that finally starts to turn opinion around on this, because he isn't an obviously political figure in the sense of being embraced by both Democrats and Republicans and respected on both sides. Both parties have used sex as a weapon to discredit their opponents whenever they can. And again, that goes back 200 years. But He's not visibly attached to either party or either faction. So one could hope against hope that this might be the turning point where people say enough already. What matters is how they do their jobs, not what their marriages are like or their private behavior. But I doubt it. You know, the fact is it does titillate, and you have a media that that literally profits from it as ratings go up and sales of newspapers and clicks on websites go up. And as long as there is a demand for this kind of coverage, the media is going to supply it. And as long as that happens, the public figures will respond accordingly.
Well, just in closing, Mark Feldstein, though, your book, Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture, is it's about a watershed moment where ever since then, scandal is more important than substance. If you go back to Jack Kennedy, all the press in the White House, press corps knew that he was up to, he had the two women on the National Security Council, codenamed Fiddle and Faddle, who swam with him every day in the White House pool. He had notorious numbers of women coming in and out of the Oval Office. Not a word was said about it. In terms of generals, I mean, General Douglas MacArthur, he had an affair with an underage Filipina girl, right? She was only 16 years old, I think, or something.
That's right, and he was 50. There's a long history of this, and there have been periods of time in our history when the press looked the other way and didn't report about it. But that has not been true for the last generation, and we now live in such a media-saturated world with so many, you know, blogs that it's impossible to censor that kind of news the way it used to be when there were a handful of establishment news outlets. It's always conceivable the pendulum could swing the other way, but just the supply and the unfettered nature of the internet. The technology involved, I think, makes it unlikely that we're going to see much of a change anytime soon.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Mark Feldstein.
My pleasure, Ian.
Again, I've been speaking with Mark Feldstein. He's a professor of broadcast journalism at the University of Maryland and author of Poisoning the Press, Richard Nixon, Jack Anderson, and the Rise of Washington's Scandal Culture. For over two decades, he's been an award-winning investigative correspondent for CNN, ABC, NBC, and is a two-time winner of the George Foster Peabody Award. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking with an Army officer who is less than enchanted with General Petraeus. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Colonel Douglas MacGregor, a decorated combat veteran and author of four books. MacGregor was commissioned into the United States Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point. He served in the Gulf War, leading the largest tank battle since World War II. MacGregor has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. And he has an article at Counterpunch, Epitaph for a Four-Star, The Petraeus Saga. Welcome to Background Briefing, Douglas MacGregor.
Hey, good to be with you.
And there's been so much adulation of General Petraeus in the press, and he, of course, cultivated the press rather assiduously. In fact, at his headquarters, not only did he have a special room for the woman that turned out to be his lover, but he also hosted people like Max Boot, who have written very, very sycophantic articles, many of them out as we speak, about the general. So it's fairly rare to hear anybody say anything about him that might be perhaps closer to the truth. And that's why I'm talking to you, because you obviously are somewhat demystifying this man.
Well, I'd say that's the understatement. You know, the neocons obviously dominated the media. The media, the mainstream media, that is, aligned itself ideologically with the neocons and their desire to intervene in these Muslim countries with the object of changing the Middle East. And Petraeus became their poster boy. You know, that's a good way to sum it up. And as a result, anything he did was justified, and anything he said was rewarded in the press with the kind of flattery that you described. The truth is that Dave Petraeus is someone very different from, I think, what the American people perceive.
And tell me why.
Well, I think Dave Petraeus is someone who was always extremely ambitious, desperate to advance in the army, but that's not unusual. But he graduated from the military academy, and he promptly married the daughter of a four-star, which is analogous to taking out an insurance policy against anything seriously wrong happening to you, at least for the first, you know, 10, 15, 20 years of your career. And if you play your cards right, as he obviously did, you can leverage that for advancement. And he pursued the usual jobs, aide-de-camp, military assistant, executive officer. He became the aide-de-camp to General Galvin, who was then a division commander as a captain. Cultivated Galvin heavily, co-wrote articles with him advancing some of Galvin's notions of light-heavy forces, became very quickly later on after he went to graduate school and arrived in the Department of Social Sciences an advocate for the use of American force in Latin America at the time. Many of your listeners will remember that we had the Sandinista problem in Nicaragua, and there were lots of people in and out of uniform talking about the use of forces, American ground forces, primarily light infantry, to intervene in that country. And Petraeus was someone who was very much part of that. And he went from the Department of Social Sciences right back to General Galvin, who by then had become a four-star and became his special assistant. And within a year of leaving General Galvin at Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers Europe, as a special assistant, he ends up as the aide-de-camp to the Army Chief of Staff, General Vono, which is where he spent his time as the Chief of Staff's aide during Desert Storm. So this is someone who was very familiar with all of the top generals, someone who ingratiated himself to the senior leaders, someone who never heard anything from a senior officer with which he could not immediately agree, someone who anxiously and enthusiastically reinforced whatever his superior said. In effect, a very articulate and effective yes man in the most serious sense of the word. He doesn't have any exposure to direct fire combat all through the 1990s and ends up as a two-star general, division commander of the 101st in 2003, and turns out to be a very disappointing commander. This was someone who did not move his division quickly. On the contrary, the division was very slow to deploy. When forces began to arrive in Kuwait and ultimately move towards Iraq, Petraeus was noteworthy for his reluctance to close with the enemy and fight. He was one of the naysayers, one of those who kept singing the song of doom and despair, arguing that we needed more forces before we advanced on Baghdad, arguing for more bombing. He was one of the co-architects of the use of our Apache aircraft in a quote-unquote deep battle, something left over from the Soviet period, against the Iraqis, which turned out so badly when they flew over a lighted city at low altitude and were shot to pieces, unsurprisingly, by the way. So this is someone who was steeped in Army orthodoxy, whatever the conventional wisdom was, always migrated to the point of consensus, supporting again whatever the senior generals thought, reinforcing those thoughts. This is not a dynamic, independent character. This is not someone who is naturally aggressive and sets himself apart as someone who's willing to take enormous risks, on the contrary. So after Baghdad falls in record time, and we take almost no losses in the process, Petraeus is in a very difficult position. But he finds his opportunity with Paul Wolfowitz, who comes and visits him in northern Iraq, where the 101st is now in an occupation mode, and convinces Wolfowitz that he can be a great nation builder and an advocate for the neocon policy of societal transformation through occupation, of transforming Muslim Arabs into Anglo-Saxon Democrats. And not long after, he becomes the leader of the new movement to create a new Iraqi armed force, a new Iraqi army. And of course, that has all sorts of problems involving the loss of thousands, hundreds of thousands of weapons, almost $1 billion. And we don't need to go into that detail, but that doesn't seem to make any difference. On the contrary, Rumsfeld seems to welcome that. And Petraeus makes himself the indispensable advocate for everything that Rumsfeld, Bush, Wolfowitz, Cheney, and the rest want to do in Iraq, and for that matter, everywhere else. And so from that point forward, the press lines up to flatter, adulate for Petraeus, and it works, and Petraeus becomes his larger-than-life figure, when in reality the true picture behind the scenes is very different. And that's what I try to outline in this short Counterpunch article, so that people understand that today this Iraq, which Petraeus claimed to be doing so many good things for, and sacrificing over 1,000 American lives during this thing called the surge, spending hundreds of millions of dollars to buy off our adversaries and help Bush get reelected, this Iraq is today effectively an Iranian satellite. No one outside of the United States questions that. And increasingly, I think the American people are well aware that Baghdad is now dominated thoroughly by Tehran, not Washington, D.C. The lion's share of the oil has not come to American oil companies. On the contrary, it's gone to Chinese and other foreign companies that had no role in the occupation. And the situation in northern Iraq with the Kurds is extremely tense, and most observers have concluded that Iraq is the next battleground on the Syrian model, where the Sunni Islamists will attempt to retake control of Baghdad and Arab Iraq from Iran. So this alleged achievement is in fact just that. It's an alleged achievement. It's a disaster. It's a strategic catastrophe. And Afghanistan is equally disappointing and equally wasteful. And the American people, I think, again, instinctively understand it. But in the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, the Washington Post, the editorial pages continue to laud what we've done as something good, when in fact it's something very bad.
Again, I'm speaking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, who is a decorated combat veteran and author of 4 books. He has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee, and has an article at Counterpunch, Epitaph for a 4-Star, The Petraeus Saga. So there's no question that the neocons and George W. Bush ended up handing Iraq over to Iran. In fact, if that war was about oil, then Iran now basically controls not only their oil, but it's the second biggest deposits in the world, Iraq's as well. So they have the potential of eclipsing Saudi Arabia. And, of course, there is a surrogate war going on between the Saudis and the Gulf, and,
yes,
and over that very issue, I'm sure. This is, I recall the Israeli military historian Martin Van Creewall described the Iraq War as the greatest strategic blunder since Emperor Augustus sends his legions into Germany in 9 AD. That may well be an understatement.
Well, strategically, he's right. But fortunately, we didn't lose all of our legions.
That's true. But,
you know,
but isn't it true that Petraeus essentially pulls Bush's irons out of the fire? The surge is really just a piece of political camouflage to make it look like the Iraq War wasn't the complete disaster that it was.
Well, I think so. I think it was clearly the determination to crush whatever Sunni Islamists and criminals that we could not bring on side with cash in downtown and suburban Baghdad was clearly an effort to create the illusion that something good had happened and to help George Bush get reelected, to effectively take Iraq off the table, to dramatically reduce the numbers of American casualties. In so doing, a lot of people, I was by no means the only one, there were lots of people in and out of uniform who said, look, you're going to end up installing Iranian national strategic power in Baghdad. You're helping Iran's allies on the ground in Iraq. But that was irrelevant. The point was, I think, to get Bush reelected, to create the illusion, and Petraeus was rewarded for this.
So his Bush's successor seems to have also been beguiled by Petraeus, and Obama, of course, set himself up for the Afghan war, saying that we took our eye off the ball and he would do it better. And I take it that Petraeus told him there's a better way to do it, and then they had surge number two. And what did that achieve?
Well, it got a lot of Americans killed. And it killed thousands upon thousands of Afghan citizens. It changed nothing, and in fact, you can say that in a perverse sort of way, the Taliban has actually thrived under attack. The result is that as we depart, Afghanistan will be divided. It will be largely dominated by the Pashtun tribes that have been fighting us. But again, there was an unwillingness to recognize that al-Qaeda was no longer the issue inside Afghanistan, that we were fighting people who fought us because we were there. The Pashtun were by no means enemies of the United States. They hadn't attacked anyone. They hadn't mounted any terrorist attacks against us or the British or anyone else. And they don't fight anywhere but inside Afghanistan. These points again were made, but it was not in Petraeus's interest to come to terms with that. I think he, at that point, had begun to believe his own press releases. He was, so to say, drinking his own Kool-Aid.
So just in closing then, Colonel Douglas McGregor, obviously this is a conversation that's not being had, and Petraeus may have fallen from grace over this somewhat soap operatic dalliance. Do you think that there will be a reckoning of the record, or is this, a lot of people now saying what they're covering up is what happened in Benghazi and that somehow he's taking the fall.
Well, we don't know. Perhaps we'll find out, perhaps we won't, but I'm sure you and most of your listeners understand that the FBI does not investigate government officials because of extramarital affairs, unless the other individual involved in the affair is a foreign agent. That was not the case. That's not the issue. I suspect there's something much deeper and more profound. But, of course, I don't know, and none of us does. Maybe we'll find out. But in any case, I think Petraeus is so to say, out of the running now for anything else that he may have thought he wanted to do. He has harmed himself.
Well, Colonel McGregor, I thank you so much for joining us here today.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Colonel Douglas McGregor, a decorated combat veteran and author of four books. He was commissioned in the United States Army in 1976 after 1 year at the Virginia Military Institute and 4 years at West Point. He served in the Gulf War, leading the largest tank battle since World War II, and has testified as an expert witness on national security issues before the House Armed Services Committee and the House Foreign Relations Committee. He has an article at Counterpunch, Epitaph for a Four-Star, The Petraeus Saga. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And the conversation continues at facebook.com/ianmastersmedia. I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Time was